And we'll get started. Welcome to the course, and this is the second lecture out of four lectures on quantitative research. And the idea of quantitative research is that quantitative research is research that we do with numbers. And there are three main issues that we need to understand when we do things with numbers. The one is, of course, what do we want to say with the numbers? Do we want to say that there is like 70% of the people who take the exam on this course don't pass the first time? It's not that high. Or do we want to say that studying more causes you to be more successful? Because those are very different kind of claims. Then the second thing that we need to do is we need to get the numbers from somewhere. So before we can analyze the numbers, we need to get them. So how do we get them? That's the thing that we're going to talk about today. And then we have the question of what do we do with the numbers? So we have a claim that we want to support with numbers, and then we have to analyze the data somehow to support our claim. Typically, the claim that we make is ultimately we make a claim that we can support with a correlation. For example, we could correlate your lecture participation with your grade, and if there's a positive correlation, we could make a causal claim that participating in the lecture helped you to to do better on the course exam. We have four lectures on quantitative research. The first lecture last week was about generally what is quantitative research, what is a causal claim, how do we justify causal claims. And today we're going to talk about measurement, which refers to where do we actually get the numbers that we analyze using quantitative techniques. Then on Thursday, we'll talk about regression analysis, which is the basic tool that we apply to rule out alternative explanations. For example, in regression analysis, we could say that our company's profitability depends on the size of the company, the industry where the company operates in, and the CEO gender. Then we let the computer to work out which of those variables is the most influential in explaining the profitability. Then on the last lecture next week, the last quantitative lecture, I will walk you through how do we actually do this in practice. I'll show you what the statistical analysis software looks like, and I'll walk you through a practice that a set of analysis that I could write a paper with. Let's review last week's things, and we spend most of our time looking at this example. So in 2005, in the summer, there was this big headline in Finnish newspapers that the return on assets, which is one of the most commonly used profitability figure, was 4.7 percentage points higher for companies that were led by women than for companies that were led by men. Then we talked, what can we really say about that? So what does that 4.7 percentage point difference tell us? And the important thing that we have to consider first is, could it be by chance only? So could it happen that the women-led companies just happen to have a good year, and the difference would be a lot less the next year, or even to the opposite direction? Because company profitability fluctuates. It's not the same. And so does it generalize to other firms? So can we generalize from that 500 companies to, let's say, the largest 5,000 companies in Finland? That's another thing that's important to consider when we think, what can we actually say from that figure? We have to then do first define, what do we really want to say? Is it enough to say that on one particular year there's a difference? And, well, that's probably something that we're not interested in. We want to say something more general. So it comes to what do we want to say? Do we want to just explain that this is how data looks like? So that's description. Or do we want to say that there is a general pattern? So when a woman is CEO, the company is generally more profitable. That kind of general relationships are useful if we want to predict. We're not necessarily saying that naming a woman as a CEO causes the company to be more profitable, but if we happen to know that women-led companies tend to be more profitable for reasons unknown, then that would be useful at least for when we choose investment targets. Then you could pick the companies that you buy stock based on who is the CEO. So that would be useful for prediction, even if we can't say that naming a woman as a CEO causes the company to be more profitable. Then when we move on to more refined arguments, we have explanations. So we are saying that the profitability differences between the men and women-led companies are caused by the one set of companies having a women CEO and the other set having a male CEO. Causal explanation or explanation then can be categorized into two different forms of explanation. One is inference. We're saying that naming a woman as a CEO causes the company to be more profitable, but we don't really know why. And that kind of claims are useful because we have many claims that we know to be true, but we don't know why. For example, many modern medicine, we have no idea why they work. We know that when we put a certain anesthetic on a person's bloodstream, they will fall asleep. We have no idea why. We are starting getting an idea of why that happens, but still we have been using that medicine for like 30 or 40 years without knowing how it works. Then the most refined version of thing that we can say with quantitative research is causal explanation. So we can confidently say that naming a woman as a CEO causes the company to be more profitable, and then we explain that it happens because women are better with social skills and therefore the top management team works better and therefore the company performs better. That kind of, we explain also why that happens. So we have these four different things that we can say with numbers. The first step in any of these, except if we just want to say that 2005 those companies happened to be more profitable, is ruling out chance as an explanation. So that's the first thing that we do. And we do the chance explanation, we rule it out using a statistic called a p-value. And the p-value basically tells us that if there is a 4.7 percentage points difference that we observe, what is the probability of observing that kind of difference or greater if there really is no difference between men and women led companies? There is no long-run difference. If we take 100 years of data, then we would identify that there is no difference between men and women led companies. That's our null hypothesis. That's the base case against which we compare. And then we compare our 4.7 percentage points difference. Could that be just the result of random fluctuations? So that's the idea of what p-value quantifies. The p-value, you don't have to know how it's calculated. The statistical software will give it to you. If you go do a PhD, then you will have to know where it comes from. But the important thing is that when it's less than 0.05, then we declare that it's called statistically significant. And that means that there's only 1 out of 20 chance to get the result that we just got by chance only. So we are okay with having these false positive findings. A false positive means that we identify from our data that there is a difference or there is a statistical relationship where, in fact, there is no such thing in the population. And that's referred to as type 1 statistical error. We make a claim about something existing where, in fact, it doesn't. Then type 2 statistical error is that there is a trend or there is a difference in the population. So men really are worse leaders than women. But our research, our study, didn't reveal that kind of relationship. We want to design our studies so that we avoid both of these mistakes. And we make true negatives. If there really is no difference, we want to make a claim that there is no difference. If there is a difference, we want to correctly claim that there is a difference. Type 1 error is typically more serious for a couple of reasons. First of all, if we were to analyze the difference between men and women-led companies and we found that there's no difference, no newspaper would publish that because it's not newsworthy. Then another interesting thing is that people generally want to make, we do policy descriptions, we do policy based on findings about what exists. If someone says that women and men are no different, that doesn't lead to any policy prescription. If someone says that women are better leaders than men, then there's a clear policy implication. So type 1 errors lead to implications and they lead to action. Type 2 errors typically don't lead to action. And that's the reason why type 1 or false positives are more serious. And we want to avoid type 1s more than type 2s. Then we talked a bit about theory. So when we do a claim that men are worse leaders than women, for example, or naming a woman as a CEO causes the company to be more profitable, we generally want to also explain why that's the case. And theory is an explanation of what happens, how, when, and why. So we have to explain what is the process, why, what do women do differently than men so that the company performance increases. And theory is also important even if we don't do a causal explanation. If we just want to say that there is causality, because we when we make a causal claim, we have to rule out alternative explanations. We talked about three conditions for causality. So when we want to say that women, naming a woman as a CEO, causes company to be more profitable, we have to show three different things. We have to show an association that the women-led companies are actually more profitable than men-led companies. We show a difference or we show a correlation, and then we show a p-value demonstrating that that kind of result or difference would be unlikely to occur by chance only. So we rule out chance as an explanation. The second thing is direction of influence. We have to show that actually women is named first and profitability comes second. We don't. If our data would show that actually it's the profitability that comes first and then woman is named as a CEO, then we couldn't say that it was actually the action of naming the woman that caused the company to be more profitable. So a simple strategy to rule out the reverse direction is to collect the data for the cause before the effect. So we could, for example, observe who was the CEO of the company last year, and what is their profitability this year. Then we know that it can't be this year's profitability that influenced the past. So that's relatively easy. The hard part is the elimination of rival explanations. For example, for this particular example, it could be that certain industries are more profitable than others, and those same industries are more likely to hire men, women CEOs than men CEOs. Or it could be that smaller companies are more profitable than larger companies, and it is easier for a woman to become a CEO of a smaller company than a larger company. And those alternative explanations would cause a positive correlation between CEO gender and profitability. And we have to rule out the alternatives. How we do that, we have two strategies. One is that we can do an experiment where we divide our sample into randomly. We divide all the companies in Finland randomly into two groups. And to one group, we assign a random Finnish woman, and the other group, we assign random Finnish man as a CEO. Then we compare the difference 1, 3, or 5 years from now. And if there's a difference, then the only reason for there to be a difference is because one group received a women CEO, other group received a male CEO, because those groups are completely indistinguishable because they were randomized. So that's the idea of an experiment. You divide groups, your sample, into two randomly, and because it's a random division, there's no systematic difference between the groups. There's no industry difference, there's no size difference between the two groups of companies, and then the only reason why there would be a difference after we do something is because we did something. So that's the idea of experiment. Experiments are sometimes done. So some people do experiments for their master's thesis, but most people do observational studies instead of experimental studies. In observational studies, the strategy number two for ruling out alternative explanations, we have to use statistical controls. And the idea of statistical controlling is that we try to think, what would a skeptic say? If we say that there's a correlation between CEO gender and profitability, we claim that it's because the woman actually is a better leader than the man. What would a skeptic say? Well, the skeptic could say that it's an industry difference, the size difference, it's evidence that women are discriminated against, and therefore it's the women who get to be leaders in major corporations are better than men because it's more harder for women to be a CEO, and so on. And that requires that we have some kind of theory of why there would be a difference. We have these alternative theories, we rule them out using a statistical analysis that we'll talk more on Thursday. So that's, in a nutshell, what we discussed last week. Any questions about last week's content? Let's talk about measurement now. And measurement refers to where do we actually get the data? And how do we measure CEO gender, for example, for the previous example? How could we, we have a list of 500 largest companies. First of all, how do we get the list of 500 largest companies? Any ideas? Internet, yeah. We use internet for data source, yeah, but where exactly from the internet? The internet is pretty large.
Maybe a Central Bureau of Statistics or something is also.
Yeah. The Bureau of Statistics does have the data, but they will not give it out because it's illegal for them to give out individual company data. But you can get it from the Finnish Trade Register, where each company files their taxes. So companies have to report how much money they made, how much revenue they brought in, how much profits they got. So we have the profitability from the company's tax filings, and that's public information. If you go to finder.fi, there is you can search for companies. You can see how much money they make. So that's public information. How do we know? How do we know which company is led by a woman, which one is led by a man? That's not directly public information. So every Finnish person has a registered gender, but that is not a required information for the company to disclose. So if you have a Finnish social security number, that social security number contains information about your biological sex. But that's not public information. There's something that is public that we could... So how do we obtain the CEO gender? Yeah, let's check the name. So the name of the CEO is public information. Every company has to disclose the CEO name. And if you go to kauppalehti.fi or the Finnish Trade Register, ytj.fi, you can check the name of the CEO. But name is not the same as gender. So how do we get from name to gender? How do we get from name to gender? Well, someone has to go through the names and guess whether it's a man or a woman. So for Finnish names, it's probably you can be 99% or more than 99% certain whether it's a man's name or a woman's name, depending on if you're a Finn or not. How about if you have a CEO called Robin Smith? Is that a man or a woman? Is Robin Smith a man or a woman? A British person, Robin Smith, would most likely to be a man but an American person, Robin Smith, would be a woman. So that's a name that is a different gender in States and UK. So sometimes, even if you have the name, you are not 100% about the gender. So we could have what we call measurement error. Our variables, we code somehow the CEO names, and we code whether they are men or women, but we are not 100% sure that we code it correctly. So there is a small degree of measurement error. Sometimes it would be something that we don't really care about. In this case, we probably are so close to correct that it doesn't matter. In other cases, how we quantify or measure things is so uncertain or imprecise that it actually makes a difference. Let's do a small classroom exercise to get started about measurement and form groups of about 3 to 4 people. And I'll give you 5 minutes to talk and try to come up with as many ways possible to measure the success of an information system project. And I will give you some boundaries. Let's assume that you are a master thesis worker, and these projects are something that have been completed in the past. So you have to think, where would you get data about information system projects, and what kind of numbers could you get that would somehow measure whether some projects were more successful than others? There are some obvious strategies, some less obvious. So what kind of data could you get?
Okay. So, what kind of ideas did you come up with for measuring information systems development project success? So, how would you measure it? Okay. Anyone else? Send a survey, send a questionnaire to people who have been working with these kind of projects and ask how they rate the previous project. That's a very common way of measuring things in information systems research. Then looking at the assets, I've never heard about that proposition before. I would have to think about it. Any others? If you have, let's say you would send out a questionnaire or do a survey, but you would ask something different, that counts as well. So there are different ways that we can measure even using a survey. Yeah, you could ask the customer satisfaction, or more generally, you could ask the user satisfaction. So you could ask the developers and ask them if the project was successful or not, and then you could ask the users if they're happy with the system or not. Are those two, if we do it both, can we expect that those two measures will be perfectly correlated? Do customers and developers always agree about the successful of, yeah. So there's the customer perspective and there's the developer perspective. Which one is better? Which one is more trustworthy? Do we trust more the developers or do we trust more the users?
Because a website can be working properly, it can be like very good, a developer has developed it properly, but the user might not be able to use all the features. The user might not know all the features of the website.
Yeah. Or the website could be very easy to use, but it could provide crappy results, crappy data, and the user would have no idea about it. That's also possible, that the users don't know. Anything else? So we could do a survey. What else can we do? Yeah. Where would we get that kind of data? Yeah, we could do a survey, or if we were to, if we could get access to companies, go and interview companies, and then tell the companies, can we take a look at your project postmortems to see if the projects were completed on time? So that would be a way of using existing documents to measure success without having to really ask. What's the advantage of using existing documents, checking the project postmortems, instead of asking people? People may not remember correctly, and particularly if you ask a developer of an information system, will the developer ever tell you that the project was a complete failure? No. No one is going to say that our project failed completely, the project that I was in charge of. Even if it failed, they're going to say that we did average. So there's this, the data that people tell you may not be trustworthy. The data that you have in the documents could be more trustworthy than what people tell you. So what's the problem in looking at project postmortems and see whether the project was completed on time? Is completion on time a good measure for the success of an information system development project? Not necessarily. It could be that the project developed something that is completely unusable and not worth a penny, but it's still completed on time. Yeah, we could check postmortems. We could say, check bug reports or how many customer support tickets complain about the system or something like that. So we could get lots of data from systems or documents from these companies without actually having to ask the people directly. And now we are starting to have three different themes here. So we have budget, we have time, and we have quality. So the first thing that you, when you start to measure something like information system development project, we have to clearly define what is it that we want to measure. So this is clearly the difference, or the success can be measured in three different dimensions. Sometimes it's okay to go over budget, but it's very bad if the quality is not optimal. Sometimes quality is secondary, but getting the system right on time and in budget is more important. For example, if you are going to be developing a system and you have to pitch it to a venture capitalist 1 week from now, what will happen if your system will be not be ready in 1 week? You're not going to get the money. So you have to deliver something. Whether it's perfect or not, it's not as important as being on time. Sometimes developing something but getting it out a bit late, it's better than developing something that doesn't work but being on time. So for example, let's say you're developing an information system to run the metro train in that goes from Helsinki to Espoo. Is it better to develop a system that kind of works but it's ready on time than to develop a system that works perfectly but it's late? Which one is better? You're going to get people killed if two trains collide. So it's better to have it right and late than have it on time and low quality. So we have to really define first what is it that we want to measure. Sometimes quantifying a concept, you can't do it with one number because these are three different things. So you have to actually collect three different measures. Or you could say that you're interested in what determines the quality, and you're not really interested in what determines whether the project is on budget or whether it's on time. And Singleton and Straits, in their book that's material for the exam, they define this is as the first step of measurement. It's called conceptualization. So you have to really explain what is the concept that you're interested in. Then when you define the concept and its dimensions, then you can start to think about how do we get data for each dimension, or are there some dimensions that we're interested in and some that we can just leave out from the study. Sometimes it's okay to ignore budget, sometimes it's okay to ignore quality, depending on what you're studying. There are... idea of measurement relates to this figure that I showed you briefly on the last week. So the main mode of inference in quantitative research is deductive reasoning. So typically we start with a theoretical claim. So we make a claim that CEO gender causes the company to be more profitable. So our first theoretical concept is CEO gender. Then we have to, we can't observe gender directly. We have to get some data, and we could put all these CEOs to medical exam, but that would be very hard to achieve, so you can't force people to go through medical exam. So we have to define an empirical concept, something for which we can get data. And the empirical concept could be the CEO's name. So we're saying that instead of measuring whether CEO gender is or sex is man or woman, we are using CEO's name as a proxy variable. So we're saying that we want to measure whether CEO's name is a man's name, for example. And that we can get data for. And then we get names of specific firms. And that's our measurement result. So we go from theoretical concept that is something that we can't really get data for to something that we can get data for to the actual data. Then we have the other performance of a company. So normally we're not interested in saying that the return on assets statistic is higher for some companies than others. We want to say that the companies perform better than others. And performance is kind of like an abstract thing, so we have to, again, find a way to quantify it. And typical way to quantify performance is return on assets, so it's kind of like a profitability figure. And then we collect return on assets data for specific companies. And these are data that we can actually get. We could do a survey, but we don't have to because it's publicly available information. We can go to Finder of FI and we can get the return on assets and the CEO name for any company. Then the idea of deductive step is that this is a theoretical proposition. So it's a general claim. And from that general claim, we make a hypothesis. So hypothesis is something that we should observe if the proposition is correct. Then we go and we check if there's a statistical association. Then we apply the three conditions for causality. We rule out alternative explanations and we show the direction of influence. Then we can conclude that the proposition is probably true. The thing about measurement is, how do we justify this relationship? So how do we justify that return on assets is actually a good measure of profitability? We could say that companies generally pay a lot of attention to their profitability figures, and return on assets is the most important. Then how do we justify that the CEO's name is a good measure for CEO gender? Well, we can justify that in the Finnish society, we have a pretty good discrimination between men and women names. We could also do a statistical statistical proof, because we have statistics about men's names, so we could say that well, only 1% of the names are ambiguous. Others are clearly man's name or women's name based on first name statistics. Then final thing, our data can come in different characteristics. We can have, we call it levels of measurement. This is from Singleton and Straits. And this is more important when we start to actually analyze the data. But quite often our data is what we call, we have a ratio scale, which means that we have a variable that has a meaningful 0 point. For example, the height of a person has a meaningful 0 point. So there's zero height, and negative height doesn't make any sense. Then we have scales. When we go from that scale to something that are numbers, we go from that number to less. Less strict, we have numbers where the interval is the same, but the 0 point is arbitrary. For example, temperature in Celsius scale, the 0 point is rather arbitrary, but we know that the difference between +1 and +2 is the same as between +2 and +3, but the 0 point is arbitrary. Then we have ordinal scale, which knows which the data have an order, but they don't really. We can't say that the difference between, let's say that we ask you on a 1 to 5 scale whether you liked lunch today, and we can't say that the difference between 1 and 2 is the same as the difference between 2 and 3. We can only say that 2 is larger than 1 and 3 is larger than 2. And then we have finally nominal scale where we don't have an order. For example, our data could be which country are you from? We can't say that Sweden is more than Finland. So it's purely a categorical variable. So that is something that we need to consider when we actually collect our data. So what kind of variables will we get? Then importantly, we discussed that there are different ways of quantifying information systems performance. And of course, when we do a study, let's say that we can think of 5 different ways of quantifying or measuring information systems performance. We have to choose 1 or 2. We can't do all just because we don't have the time. And if we were to write a paper that uses 5 different ways of measuring, then that would be more complicated to the reader than just using 1 or 2. So how do we choose which way we measure? And to do that, we have to define what are the characteristics of good measurement. Did you have a question? Yeah, you were just going like that. So the characteristics of good measurement we covered a bit yesterday, or last week. The important parts are reliability and measurement validity. Reliability means that if we measure the same thing again, we get the same result. If we ask the users from an information systems user whether they like the system and we ask them to rate it from 1 to 5 now, and we do the same question tomorrow, are we going to get the same result? No. So if we do a course feedback 1 week after the course and 2 weeks after the course, the results will be slightly different because there's some randomness in how you respond. Let's say that you think that it's actually the system is worth 4.5, but that's not an option. So then you randomly choose between 4 and 5. And that's rather arbitrary. So do you think that if we check project postmortems and whether a project was completed on time, we do the check now and we do the check from the same postmortem 1 week from now, do we get the same result? Unless we misread the report, we're going to get the same result. So that's reliable. Then we have validity. Does the number actually measure what we want it to measure? And so validity. So that's, and measurement validity is sometimes in the literature referred to as construct validity, but it's I prefer the term measurement validity because construct validity has a specific meaning. But if you see someone talking about construct validity, then they basically mean most of the time of whether their data measures the thing that it is supposed to measure. I showed you this example last time. So measurement, reliability, and validity are like precision and accuracy. So precision is reliability, and it means that you get the same result over and over if you repeat the study or repeat the measurement. But it doesn't tell you anything about whether the number really quantifies well the thing that you are interested in. We could ask users, and that doesn't really quantify the information system success completely. It gives you a part of it, but not completely. Then we have reliability, which is the same as or validity, which refers to whether we actually measure the thing that we're interested in measuring. What can we do about the lack of precision? If we have, let's say that someone is shooting a target and we have the hits that are every time they're off. So what can we do? We just have to adjust the gun or switch to a different gun. So the only way of fixing this issue is that we measure things differently. How do we fix this kind of problem? We get results that are all over. Let's say that a practical example. I like to use an example of a wiggling child. So you have a child that wiggles, and you want to weight them. So you put the child to a scale, and you get some number. Because the child wiggles, we know that the result that the scale shows us will be imprecise. How do we measure the child's weight more precisely? Yeah, measure multiple times, take an average. That's what we do in research most of the time. So every time you answer a questionnaire asking you whether you like the food at the cafeteria or not, and you have 5 different wordings, the idea is that those are repeated measures of the same thing. And then the researcher processing the data will take an average of those two. So that's the reason we have surveys that repeat the same question slightly differently. It works really well in some settings. Other settings, it doesn't work at all. So we take an average to improve reliability. Validity, if our measures are not measuring what they're supposed to measure, we can't do anything about it. If we have, except to measure the thing differently. If we have a reliability problem, we can measure over and over and take a sum. And that's what near every information systems paper does. Then we have the question of how do we justify these relationships? So how do we justify that our measurement results are reliable, and how do we justify that these empirical concepts, for example, survey question or whether a CEO's name is a man's name or not, are valid measures of the theoretical concept? So we have to justify these relationships. This one is hard, and this one is a lot easier. So when we first talk about validity, so whether our measures actually measure what they're supposed to measure. The problem with validity is that when you start reading any research manual, you run into these terms. So there are dozens of different terms that somehow describe whether there are variables measure the thing they're supposed to measure or are somehow as evidence of validity. That you don't have to know all these terms, and we're not going to ask you those terms in the exam. You have to just understand the basic idea of validity. And the basic idea of validity and the relationship between the things that we actually can observe is that our data, the thing that we actually observe, the list of CEO names, the list of survey responses, depends on the thing that we want to measure. So people who like the food at the cafeteria are more likely to respond five to a question that asks whether they like the food or not than one. People who didn't like the food are more likely to respond to one. And the data kind of like reflects the thing that we are interested in. But there's also a problem that the data are not the 1 to 5 scale, for example, on lunch satisfaction, is not the exact same thing as whether you like the lunch a lot or not. Because there is some randomness, and there are many different sources of measurement error. So our data is a sum of measurement error and sum of variation due to the thing that we want to measure. Now we have to explain in our research paper or in our master's thesis that there is a lack of random error. So randomness doesn't drive our observed data. The random error, is it reliability or validity? No, random error is reliability. So reliability was the left side, so there's lots of random error here. So random error, spread out randomness, that's reliability. Lack of reliability, and this is lack of validity. So it's systematic error. So we have to rule out random error and systematic error as a source of the relationships in our data. So how do we actually go about doing that? So reliability is quite easy. And reliability, in practice, what we do is that we have these multiple questions. This is from the Venkates paper, and they are measuring, they show the questions. They are measuring accuracy and completeness of information using a questionnaire to people who use e-government systems. They have 3 questions about accuracy and 3 questions about completeness. The idea is that these are independent measures of accuracy. These are independent measures for completeness. So we kind of like, we triangulate. So we triangulate from different perspectives, and then we take a sum of those measures or a mean. It doesn't matter which one you take. And if these 3 questions about accuracy are highly correlated, then we conclude that they measure the same thing, and they do so reliably. This is also explained in the paper. So they have this section about measures, and they say that they did some kind of survey, and they average responses to each relevant item to create a score for its variable. So most research articles do that, they don't report it because it's so common. But this one does report it, which is nice. And then they have the next section, they assess reliability and validity, and they explain that Chromebox alphas or composite reliability indices were more than 0.7. And that is taken as evidence of reliability. I'll explain that in a few slides from now. Before we talk about reliability and validity, we have to talk about whether things are unidimensional or not. And unidimensional means that you can quantify a phenomenon using one number. Can we quantify information systems projects' success with one number? We really can't. We have, whether it's on budget, on time, and whether the system is of high quality. So we have three different dimensions. So it's not unidimensional. We have to define the dimensions. So let's take an example. Let's say that we have person's size. We want to quantify a person's size using one number. And we use height and weight, and we take a sum. And my size is 250. So is that a... Is it meaningful to say that my size is 250? It is not, because I could be a short and fat person, or I could be a tall and skinny person. We could say that I'm most likely not an NBA basketball player. We could also say that I'm most likely an adult based on this number. But that's about it. So we can't really merge these things into one number. So we have to first... When we start assessing reliability and validity, we have to make a call whether the data that we're using, the numbers that we're using, are actually measures of the same thing. Person's height and size are not the same thing. This relates to convergent and discriminant validity. These two concepts are related to the correlations. So if we have... Let's say we have three variables that are supposed to measure information accuracy. Then those three numbers should be highly correlated. And we have three numbers that are supposed to measure system responsiveness, for example. Then those three numbers are supposed to be should be highly correlated. And also, that is convergent validity. Do the variables that are supposed to measure the same thing correlate highly? Then discriminant validity refers to whether the correlations between information accuracy variables are more higher than correlations between information systems, information accuracy variables, and system responsiveness variables. So we have discriminant validity refers to whether two indicators or two sets of indicators or variables measure two different things. And that is something that we have to first, in an empirical article, demonstrate before we can start to assess reliability. Conceptually, it's kind of a difficult thing to understand, but how you actually assess that the variables measure one thing and one thing only is pretty straightforward. And we do that using a tool called factor analysis. So factor analysis is a statistical tool that we give the statistical tool. Let's say that we are interested in five different things. We are interested in information system success, and we are interested in four concepts that we argue explain information system success. We do a survey. We measure each with three questions. So we have 15 questions altogether. Then we give those 15 questions, the data, to a computer, and we ask the computer to do a factor analysis for us. What the computer does then is it checks which indicators, which variables correlate so highly together that we can conclude that they measure the same thing, and it groups the variables. So it tries to find like smaller dimensions or group the data, and if the indicators or the questions are grouped according to how we plan them to be, then we argue that there's empirical evidence for discriminant and convergent validity. How it works, the result looks like, you don't have to know how to apply, it's just point and click, but the result looks like this in a published paper. So this is from the Venkates paper again. And they have these things, they're measuring 11 different things, and they have 20 to 30 different survey questions that they use to measure those things. Factor analysis groups, and it says that these accuracy indicators, for example, belong to one factor, and they are not very sensitive to other factors. Also, these other indicators are not very sensitive to the first factor. That is evidence that these three indicators measure the same thing, and what they measure is distinct from the other indicators, other variables. So factor analysis, we want to show that there's each variable belongs to one factor and one factor only. That's evidence of validity. Typically, in an article, they bold the highest values to show what's the pattern, and then you can infer that, this was a pretty successful survey study. Then we have exploratory factor analysis, confirmatory factor analysis. The difference is a bit technical. In confirmatory, you specify which indicators should be grouped into factors, and then you let the computer to test it. In exploratory, you just give the computer data and tell the computer to find the factors for you. Exploratory factor analysis is a lot easier to apply than confirmatory factor analysis. So when you do your master's thesis, I recommend that you do exploratory factor analysis. When you do your PhD, then I recommend that you do confirmatory factor analysis if you apply quantitative technique. But this is always, when you do a survey study, you have to apply factor analysis to assess whether the variables or the questions in the survey measure the same thing. Yeah. Then in factor analysis, this is also a bit technical thing, but if you want to, if you actually apply exploratory factor analysis, how it works, that it will first find one general factor from the data. So if we have person one here, person two here, we can see that items 4, 5, and 6 should go together. 1, 3, and 2 should go together. But what factor analysis first finds you is that at what direction all the factors are. And then what remains, it finds another factor. So it says that all items are on this direction, and then item 2, item 3 differ from item 5, 4, 6, that they are on that direction from the overall direction. So because of that, we do something called a factor rotation. So we try to, instead of saying that where the indicators are and how do they differ, we rotate it a bit so that the one arrow points to one group of items, the second arrow to the second group of items. And then there are different ways of doing rotation. The important takeaway of this is that if you apply factor analysis, you don't have to understand the technicalities of what rotation does. You have to understand that you have to do it after factor analysis, and then you have to apply Oblimin or Promax or something that's called an oblique rotation. This is also reported in the Venkates paper. So they report that they conducted an exploratory factor analysis with Oblimin rotation to allow for correlated factors. So you report how you did the factor analysis. Important things, if you do a survey, always do a factor analysis. It's evidence of validity. Then always rotate the solution and use Oblimin or Promax. And you can just check what the Venkates paper did, because that's a pretty well-done paper. Then there's also some people apply a principal component analysis. And principal component analysis, it's applied instead of a factor analysis. That's an analysis mistake. The reason why people apply for principal component analysis is that when you're using SPSS, which is the statistical tool that most beginners use, and I also recommend that for you for master's thesis, because it's freely available. We have a license for all students, as far as I know. And when you do a factor analysis, the default thing that it does is a principal component analysis.
So people point and click, and they apply these techniques without knowing what they actually do. So you have to remember not to use principal component analysis. The difference is not important for this class. Then after we have done a factor analysis to demonstrate that the items, certain items go together, then we can use the correlations between those items as a measure of reliability. How we do that in practice, we calculate a statistic called Cronbach's alpha. So Cronbach's alpha, you don't have to know what's the actual definition, but it's typically we say that when Cronbach's alpha is more than 0.7, it says that 70% of our scale score, or the sum of the items, is relevant variation, and 30% is random error. We're typically okay with that. Of course, more reliability is better, but we're typically okay with 70% reliability. Both of these, Cronbach's alpha and composite reliability, which is often reported instead of Cronbach's alpha, which is calculated a bit differently, but conceptually almost the same, both rely on the assumption that the variables that you put into the Cronbach's alpha, so you have five variables, you tell the statistical software to calculate alpha for you, then it assumes that they measure the same thing. But it doesn't provide you a test, so you always have to do a factor analysis to assess whether indicators measure the same thing. Summary of measurement. So important concepts in measurement include reliability. Do you get the same result if you measure the same thing again using the same technique? So that's lack of random error. If we analyze documents that somebody has written, if we repeat the analysis again, we're probably going to get the same result. If we ask people's attitudes about something today and tomorrow, it's probably going to be slightly different. And that's reliability. Then validity, do the things, the variables that we have, the data that we have, does it accurately reflect the phenomena that we are interested in? So does it actually measure what it is supposed to measure? IQ test, for example, if I did an IQ test, that measures, that's a valid measure of my intelligence. Measuring the circumference of my head, it's very reliable, but it is not a valid measure of intelligence. Then we have reliability. So reliability, how we assess reliability is that we measure the same thing over and over. For example, we have survey questions that are repeated using slightly different wordings. If they correlate highly, we conclude that they're reliable. If they don't correlate highly, we conclude that they're not reliable. Then validity is typically done with the factor analysis, but we can't really prove that our data are valid. We can only show some evidence that they could be valid in the form of factor analysis. Okay, then we have, if we do a survey study, which most people in information systems do at some point in their career, so that's the most common way of collecting data. We have an alternate explanation. So if we have this kind of measurement item, measurement form, we have six questions. The question accuracy one is, I expect government information on government websites to be accurate. The completeness question one, I expect government websites to provide me with comprehensive government information. We find that these two questions are correlated at 0.8 or something that is very high. What could be the case? Why? Well, the inference that we want to do is that the first indicator on this scale and the first indicator on that scale are correlated because they measure accuracy and completeness, and accuracy of information and completeness of information are correlated for some reason. Or it could be that if we do this survey in the United States, we could have people who are conservatives, who hate government. We are liberals who love government services.
and the indicators both measure hostility toward government. So it could be that there is the variables or the survey questions that we ask are measuring actually something that we are not interested in, but something that influences both measures. So, or they could measure how frequently, whether you like to answer to the five or to the end points of the scale. For example, if someone asks me to rate something on a 1 to 5 scale, I hardly ever choose 1 or 5 because I think that's kind of like extreme. Some people, they choose between 1 and 5. So it could be that both measure how likely a person to respond to 1 or 5, regardless of what is being asked. So we have these things that we have to rule out. And this is called method variance. So the idea is that our indicators, our variables, don't measure only the concepts that they're supposed to measure, but they measure also how people are likely to respond to any questions generally. And if you do a survey study yourself, that's an issue that you have to take into account. There are statistical techniques that you can apply, and it's called common method variance. So that's from the Venkates paper. They do something, and they cite some articles. What they actually do, you have to familiarize if you do a survey yourself. But just if you're a reader of a survey-based studies, you don't have to know that in detail. So we have to do this method variance check, factor analysis, reliability analysis with alpha. And that's after that, we can take some of the accuracy items, some of the completeness items, and then apply those in regression analysis. The research process that I talked about briefly yesterday is very much related to about measurement and sampling. So measurement, what data do we collect? Sampling, where do we collect it? So if we want to study the relation between studying and performance in the exam, which students do we take into our analysis? Do we only take this class? Do we take a random sample of all our information system students? Or do we take a random sample of all students in this university? So that's about sampling. The thing is that once you do your survey study, then your response is coming. You can't change the questions anymore. So when you have 100 responses to your survey, if you realize that you forgot to ask an important question, you can't go back to those 100 people and ask the question again, unless you have their cell phone numbers, because that's pretty much the only way. If you have their email addresses, and you ask them a follow-up question, maybe a 30% will answer that. So you have to call them, right, everybody. So making sure that you ask the right things and you ask enough questions is very important. That determines the quality of the study. If your data comes from a database, let's say that you have project postmortems that you analyze to measure which projects were successful or which are not, then you always have the option of going back to those original documents and collect more variables. So let's check whether the project manager was a man or a woman and did that influence on the project success or something like that. But if you do a survey, then once you publish it, then you're basically set how good the study is going to be. The important parts about reliability, measurement was reliability and validity. Measurement validity is sometimes referred to as construct validity. Let's go back to the example of measuring information system responsiveness or information system responsiveness, which we can think of as a sub-dimension of information system quality. So responsiveness means when you use the system, does the system respond to your queries quickly, or do you have to wait? And we have generally in singleton straits, they explain 4 different designs, and the first design that they explain for any social science is the laboratory experiment. idea was that you somehow you divide people into two groups. You apply a treatment to one group. One group receives the medicine, other one doesn't. You see, check what will happen. Then you have survey. You ask people's opinions, typically through the form of questionnaire. Sometimes you do interviews. Then we have field research, which refers to going to the field and observing what happens without actually asking people's opinions. Then we have archival records, for example, going to the government database and check return on assets. And we're going to do a small classroom exercise now, and you get to come up with different ways of measuring information systems responsiveness. So this is a more refined or more specific quality than the overall quality. Come up with one or two ways of measuring information systems responsiveness using each of these designs, and then you get to explain what's an advantage and disadvantage of that design in terms of reliability and validity. Groups, the same groups as before. And I'll give you 5 minutes, then we'll talk about that, and then I'll leave you for lunch. One more thing as a motivation, these classroom exercises have been exam questions as well in the past. Thank you. Okay, so how could we study information systems responsiveness in a laboratory experiment? So you talked about all the other designs except that one. So the idea of experiment is that we divide people into two groups. Then we manipulate one group and we don't manipulate the other group. Then we compare the difference. How could we do it in the context of information systems responsiveness? Can we manipulate information system responsiveness? So let's say that the responsive system responds in 10 milliseconds or 100 milliseconds, and an unresponsive system takes 5 seconds. Can we manipulate it? Yeah, sure. We do... some kind of small information system, we program it, and we have a people in a lab, we give them a task. One, the group uses a system where we just program the system to be really slow. So we say that we have like sleep statements, if you know programming. Then we can compare. Do those people who use the system that is artificially made to be slow, are they more satisfied than those people who are using the system without any constraints, any ways of making it slow by design? Of course, the people who use the system that is faster are going to be more satisfied. There's no question about that. The question is the difference large or not? So, is it large enough to warrant optimizing systems or not? How could we do the same study using survey? So survey was about asking people. How could we measure information system responsiveness using a survey?
You can ask the users about
the
system responsiveness.
Yeah. We could have, for example, if we wanted to study the responsiveness of the Korppi system, we could ask students, the last time you used Korppi, was it responsive? Did you get the information in a timely fashion? Was the system fast to use? So we could do that. Or we could ask more generally, the last time when you used an information system, was that information system responsive or not? So that's fairly easy. Then we asked in the same survey, we asked some variable that we want to explain. How could we do a field study? So field study is about going and observing what people do without manipulation or without asking them. How could we do a field study of information system responsiveness? We could monitor a system. So for example, but that's more of the archival records. So we could monitor the people. So we go to a place where people use information systems. For example, we could go to the computer lab. We could just see what happens, record if a person is experiencing a slow system or not, and then record whether they're frustrating or not. We could go to the library to see when people use different systems, is the system performing fast or not. That's usability testing. Quite often does that. So people come to a setting where you test an actual system. The system is not manipulated anyway. Then you tape it. And then later on you code whether that system was responsive for the user's queries and whether the user appeared to be satisfied or not. That's kind of like a field study. It's not an experiment, even if it's taken in a, done in a lab, because there's no manipulation. So experiment was about manipulation and randomization. Field studies about observing what happens. How do we study responsiveness using archival data? Yeah, you can check the log files. If the system is used over the web browser, as they usually are nowadays, you can check the log files. The log files will tell you how long the query took place. Then we can check whether those users or sessions that have the response times in the seconds or milliseconds, if they're more satisfied, if they quit their session prematurely without completing the task and so on. So we can collect use existing log files. So that's one thing. All of these designs have been used in the information systems research. So what's the advantage of lab experiment over the others in terms of measuring? The advantage of lab experiment is that it has a built-in way of making causal claims. We don't have to worry about ruling out alternative explanations because dividing people randomly into two groups makes the two groups comparable. Then the only difference between those groups is because of the treatment. What's the disadvantage with experiments? Yes, you can repeat it, and experiments are typically highly repeatable because you document what you did, and then you provide the materials, and then others can replicate it. So these are repeatable. The problem is, with experiments, it has basically two problems. Experiments can be costly because programming a system that people use takes a lot more time than just writing a survey questionnaire and distributing it out. So it's more costly than surveys. And also, what you can study with experiments is more limited than what you can study with surveys. For example, we can't study the effect of CEO gender on profitability with an experiment because we have no way of assigning the CEOs of companies. What's the advantage and disadvantage of surveys? Sometimes we have an anonymous survey. We don't know who answers. Sometimes surveys are non-anonymous, so we know exactly who's going to answer. I try to do non-anonymous surveys because then it allows me to combine background data on the people and the companies, and also call people if they didn't provide some information. What's the advantage of surveys? That's a disadvantage, maybe biased. So the disadvantage of surveys is that people may not answer trustworthy. So when you ask a developer of a system, is your system any good? They're going to say that it's pretty good, even if it's pretty bad. So you can't always trust that the people give you the right information. The advantage of surveys is that it's very easy to get a large sample size. We could easily get 200 responses to a survey, any survey, by just going doing paper questionnaires and going to the cafeteria. So we can easily get data. So it's an inexpensive design. What's the field research? What's the advantage and disadvantage? What's the advantage of field research compared to surveys? The advantage is that when we actually observe what people do, we don't have to rely on people themselves providing us accurate information. We can, instead of looking, asking people if they like the lunch or not, we look at their faces and what they look like when they're eating. That's more valid than asking people's opinions. The disadvantage of field study is that it may be difficult to set up a field study because you have to get access to a setting where you can observe people to do the thing that you're interested in studying. For example, if we are studying information systems responsiveness, we have to figure out a way of going somewhere and observing a place where people use responsive and unresponsive systems, and also do so without violating their privacy concerns. So doing field studies could be difficult. They are also not as replicable, because having access to a field typically requires that you know people in a company, and not everyone knows the same people. What's the advantage and disadvantage of using archival records, for example, log files to study system responsiveness?
It's readily available,
and if we have, let's say we have the university website and we want to study its responsiveness, we have a large number of observations, so we have lots of data that are easily available. What if we wanted to study the effects of corpus system responsiveness on user satisfaction using log files? What would be the challenge in that? How do you determine the satisfaction? You don't have the data for the satisfaction. So archival records, you usually have data for some of the variables of interest, and you have lots of data. Sometimes you don't have. Then we would have to, for example, try to somehow infer whether the person got the thing or managed to complete the task that they were trying to do in Corpia, or whether they decided to quit the task. But that would be a very low validity way of measuring satisfaction. So there are advantages and disadvantages in all of these designs. And when people start doing a quantitative study, the first thing that many people think is, what are we going to ask in our survey? Who is going to answer our survey? They don't really think about the big picture that you can study things quantitatively by using other means but survey as well. Let's summarize this lecture. The key things from this lecture is that we try to get some samples, and the challenge of using observed data to measure theoretical concepts is that our data, the answer from 1 to 5 on whether you like the lunch today or not, is not the same as satisfaction with lunch. So the observed variable and the theoretical concept are not the same. So that's one challenge. We have to do reliability and validity analysis. And here, reliability means the degree to which, if we repeat the study, are the results going to be the same. So it's degree to which the variables that we collect are influenced by random noise. Sometimes you have noisy data, sometimes you don't. The way of dealing with reliability is that we measure the same thing many times, we take an average, and if those multiple independent measures correlate highly, then we conclude that they are reliable after we have established their unidimensionality using a factor analysis. Then validity refers to whether the variables or indicators measure the thing that they're supposed to measure, and we do that with discriminant and convergent validity checks using a factor analysis, not principal component analysis. So we show that those indicators that measure the same thing are clustered together, and they are distinct from indicators that are supposed to measure something else. Then quality of a study is reliability, measurement validity, statistical conclusion validity, internal validity, and external validity. Today we talked about reliability and measurement validity. We are going to be talking about the three final kinds of validity or facets of validity in the last two lectures on quantitative research. For the next lecture, I want you to prepare by reading chapters 15 and 16 from Singleton and Straits, and we're going to be continuing by taking examples from the Venkatesh paper, so it may be a good idea to skim through that or maybe have it printed with you. We're going to have one exam question. I don't know if Arta published those online. It's going to be one of the exam questions that's going to be new for this year's pool is going to be, how do you interpret table number 2 in that paper? We're going to be looking at that on Thursday. And if you pay attention in the class, it's going to be helpful for you to answer the question in the exam as well. Any questions? The slides are going to be are online now, and I'm going to post the link on the first page of the slides to the lecture video as soon as I get it from the IT support, which should be sometime this afternoon.